Hello, everyone. This is Steve Martin. Welcome to Stars on Tap. Today is June the 24th, 2014. From Big Dog Productions, we have Charlo Crossley. Charlo was in the Emmy Award-winning films, HBO's Behind the Candelabra. She had a Golden Globe and an Emmy. She's also been in the Academy Award-winning 20 Feet from Stardom. This is Charlo Crossley. Welcome, Charlo.
Good morning, where you are, or good afternoon, wherever you are. And it's good to hear from you, Steve. Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, you know, I'm very flattered to have you. You have such a rich history of music itself, and now the film thing seems to be coming around, and you've done some pretty amazing things. I sat last night and watched 20 Feet from Stardom on Netflix. We sat outside, my wife and I watched the show, and there was so much information to gather from that and so much history, you know. It's just an amazing thing, and give me your thoughts on being part of the film 20 Feet from Stardom to start with.
Well, I have my very dear friend Rudy Calvo to thank for bringing me to Morgan Neville's attention, and you know, we really didn't know what this thing was going to be. But, you know, when you get into, when people come and interview you for different things over the years and you start telling your story, and Morgan asked some very interesting questions about, you know, certain people and the process of how did you get there, and we just basically scratched the surface. But we're all very grateful. I'm very, very grateful for being a part of the film, to have made the cut. A lot of my friends were, a lot of people did get interviewed for this movie, and I'm grateful that I did not end up on the cutting room floor, and that I was able just to tell a little, just a little peanutty bit of how I came to get, how I became a background singer. It was really like having a secretarial job. It was my bread and butter gig. I had come into show business through legitimate theater. I was in the musical Hair. I got in it right out of high school. I was doing community theater in Chicago where I grew up. And I just loved show business. And I loved the movies and television. And of course, you know, I was being a teenager and going to school and taking music and being in the chorus and singing in church, I kept my secret that I wanted to be in this industry. And I knew that it would be tough, but it was also very lonely because I didn't have a lot of support for that. So I was on a journey by myself for quite a few years. And I made so many wonderful friends who became family to me. And you know, this was back in the 60s, and it was interesting because with all this incredible music and this, I mean, you had the whole R&B scene was really exploding, you know, and you had rock and roll and pop music. Everything was still pretty very, 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 you know, the backdrop of this was, you know, intense segregation and a lot of, you know, undercurrent of unrest, and it was very, it was just very hard. It was a very hard thing to conceive of, but I was fearless. I didn't look at how hard it was. I was very blessed to have some doors open for me, and I was able to leave Chicago and go to Vegas and do the show in Vegas and then go to New York and travel around the world. You know, when I moved to New York, I met Bette Midler, and that set my life on another journey, because when I left the Broadway show that I was doing in New York, actually I was doing a show in New York. We were just about to open. It was our last day of previews and the day before we opened. And she came and asked me if I would replace Melissa Manchester as one of the Harlettes. And I said yes. And then the next day our show opened, and then we got our notice, and we closed at the end of the week. So that's how that whole thing that's how that whole thing, you know, transpired, really. So that was a 5 to 7 year journey working with her. And it was wonderful that I had the theater background, because that gives you a discipline to begin. That just gives you a discipline, a work ethic, and, you know, you're not afraid to get in there and rehearse like a crazy person, you know. And she was a perfectionist, so we were constantly tweaking, retweaking, learning more songs. I learned so many songs in a very short period of time. But before that, I had started doing background work, background singing work while I was on Broadway. So on my off days, sometimes I get a call and, come on, Charlo, we're going to go sing these demos for the songwriter at the Brill Building. So we would go, and we would go to one of these studios, and we'd just knock out these songs for $25 a song, and we may do 5 or 6 songs. Just knock it out, you know. And then that's how I got into that scene. And I really loved it. But, you know, it was I wasn't aware at how fiercely competitive it was at the time, because I was in a Broadway show. So, you know, I'd go in the studio and do the song. I was, you know, 20 years old, just about to turn 21 on Broadway. And so it was just kind of, yeah, this is what I do. I wasn't ambitious at that time. I think it took me 10 years to start to finally become somewhat ambitious in this business. But being a background singer, you've got to have very, very keen musicality, either good ear training or sight reading, but you've got to have the pipes, and you've got to be able to flow with what's going on. You know, sometimes we would go in and do sessions, and there was no chart, there was nothing to go on except the track, and we would build and a crazy scratch vocal from somebody, from the artist. So that's how we would build the track.
You know, that's amazing that you know, I mean, a lot of musicians read music, but a lot of musicians feel music, and they know inherently what the artist, the main artist, is looking for,
or they don't know how to make it happen.
Yeah, or that artist doesn't know, and he's looking at you guys to come up with something to build from and put his ideas on, and that's really hard. I mean, that's got to be just walk in and inherently know what someone wants or someone needs or what a song needs, and to nail it right away, because you don't have a lot of time. Then go get somebody else.
Well, you know what? Back then, Mary Clayton talks about this, the girls talk about this in the movies, all of us have had this experience where, you know, a lot of times we're in the studio into the wee hours, and so sometimes you go in and you work, somebody's calling you and you just go, I just need you to come in and put vocals on this track.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be so bare bones. And back then, you know, we were dealing with tape. We didn't have any of the digital technology then, but the tape was very important. So we would get a good basic track, and then we could build on that and add some harmonies. And just the art of building a song from nothing. And, you know, that was the, when I look back on those sessions were really exciting, because we were allowed to really be very, very creative, you know, and they could take and edit out, you know, and back then, the longest a song could be was 3 minutes and 30 seconds.
Mm.
This is before, you know, this is before Jimi Hendrix, and this is before James Brown did his, like, 6 minute, there was a time album, you know, there were maybe 2 or 3 songs on a 33 and a third, one side, A side, and the songs were 6 or 7 or 8 minutes long, but these were like dance tracks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm getting, you know, so, but that's what we were dealing with back then. But the highly, highly, highly creative moments like that, what happened on with Phil Spector, he recorded like that. You know, a lot of people a lot of producers and composers, they had it, sometimes they had it on the page, and then they'd get the singers in, they'd have the readers come in, and then they'd hire all the other soulful singers to come in to give it flavor. And but see, the readers were very limited. Darlene Love talks about this, because if it wasn't on the paper, they weren't singing it. So they would be bring the rest of us soul singers in to bring flavor to it. You know, and that was very prominent. That was very, very prominent here in California. In New York, it was a little bit of a different scene, but soon it became that it opened up like that. But that's how that whole thing, you know, came about. I mean, we listened to music as a kid. I always listened to the background. I always was interested in what they were singing, you know. And if you did, and if you sang in the church choir, I don't care if it was a Baptist choir or a Pentecostal choir or a Presbyterian or Methodist, if you had choir experience, then you were able to flow with that kind of vibe. You know, it was crucial. And it's so interesting, because when you watch the movie and you hear all of our stories, we all have a very, very solid church choir singing background, you know. Praise leader, worship leader, choir director. You know, we all come out of that tradition.
Yeah, well, she's going to have to bark.
That's okay.
It's okay. Let's go ahead and go ahead.
Sure.
On Saturday, July the 5th, 2014 at 6 p.m., Charlotte will be the opening act for the Supreme Partners Live at the Sheraton Gateway at the LAX International Airport in Los Angeles, California. Get your tickets now by calling 213-494-1291. I do apologize for Bella. She's a house guest.
All right,
and but anyway, it never fails. That's live radio. That's the way
right.
It is.
Hey, that's what makes it real. I love it. I love the dog barking in the background.
Shut up, Bella. Sorry.
That's quite all right, my friend. That's quite all right.
You now, like I say, you're working toward doing this thing with the Supreme Ladies. Tell us about your part of that show.
I'll be opening for them. We just, Suze and Sherry and myself were just part of a big singers event here in L.A. for the Society of Singers, which is a nonprofit organization that takes care of singers in their time of need. And we did a wonderful benefit with them. I was singing with the Blossoms, and that's a group that I do sing with. And that group was also featured in the movie 20 Feet from Stardom. I just started working with them, and it's incredible. And Sherry and Suze both were on the bill that night, and they were sensational. So there's going to be a definite repeat of their solo performances, and they'll be singing together as a duo, and I open for them. And so I'm going to be doing some songs from my club act that I have been performing around town, and it's a wonderful opportunity to get in front of a whole new group of people and sing some old songs and, you know, really, really good, solid entertainment.
Absolutely. That's got to be a fantastic show you're putting together.
We just started rehearsing, and it's just going to be really beautiful. There's a man that's come on board, a friend of Suze's, who's a wonderful motivational speaker. So it's going to be an incredible evening. It's going to be very positive, a very positive evening of entertainment. And I like the fact that we're all seasoned veterans. And, you know, it's funny, the other night we were saying that, you know, between at the Society of Singers event, we had about 500 years of work experience.
Wow. That's a little bit of time.
Yeah, I would. You think? Yeah, absolutely. But the girls are just beautiful and bring such diversity of their creativity to the table. And, you know, they have a history of being Supremes, and I've got a history of being in the Harlettes with Bette Midler and with the Blossoms. So we've all got a very, very solid girl group history, girl group foundation that we stand on.
So we're selling tickets. We're selling tickets now, is that correct?
Well, praise God, yes, we are. We are. And I just encourage everybody to call or go online, supremepartners.com. I think that's the website.
It is.
And to click on the links, and we want to see people come out.
Well, you know what? We're trying to work on that for you.
All right. I really appreciate that. I'm looking forward to see folks to come up. There'll be people. There'll be. I'll have my CD single for sale, and the girls will have their new re-release on sale. For sale, and we're just looking forward to seeing people come. They bring their memorabilia. We'll be happy to sign it, and it'll be wonderful just to meet everybody. I'm looking really forward to this. This is a very exciting event, and for some worthy causes.
Oh, absolutely. And again, I do want to mention it's July the 5th, 2014 at 6 p.m. At the Sheraton Gateway at the L.A. International Airport in Los Angeles. You can call tickets at 213-494-1291. So be sure if you're in that area, try to gather up some cash and go check out these ladies who are going to put on a wonderful show. I wish I could be there. Absolutely.
Bringing it to your neck of the woods. That would be fine.
Well, you know
you,
what?
Are you outside of Louisville?
Lexington, yes.
Lexington, okay. Yep. That's one of events can be created. We could come. It would be fabulous.
That would be an awesome thing to go witness, and I'd love to see that happen. A couple other things I wanted to talk to you about. I know we're running a little bit late, but you know, there's so much history and information here that I was telling my co-producer Ray Aroma that I can't possibly put this in 15 minutes. There's no way. You have to take some time. I'm sorry?
Maybe do part one and then part two.
Yeah, maybe so. We should do that probably. You're singing with the Blossoms. Tell me about that real quick.
Oh, wow. Well, let's see. I had met Finita James. Of course, I knew Darlene. I knew Darlene from New York because Darlene and I both were in Hairspray. She played Motormouth Mabel. And when she left the show, our friend Jennifer Lewis took over for her. And when Jennifer left, I came in and took over for Jennifer, and subsequently closed out the New York company of Hairspray in 2009. But I had come to know Darlene just over the years, and always loved her, always just admired her. And when I was a teen girl, I would go, what she's doing, that's what I want to do. So that's the amazing miracle that a group that I admired for so many years and loved the sound that I got a chance to be a part. And so Finita James, once again, our dear friend Rudy Calvo suggested to her that she hire me to come in the group and sing Darlene's some of Darlene's solos with the group. And you know, and we had a trio. It was me, Finita, and Patty Brooks, Miss Patty Brooks, and now it's Finita, me, Patty Brooks, and Billy Barnum, and Finita go way, way back. In fact, all of us go way back, but it's a very wonderful group, and we're singing a lot of wonderful oldies. We're doing He's a Rebel and Zippity Doodah. We sang some Sherelle's tunes the other night, and I'm learning a lot more of their repertoire, but it's happy music, and we sound like little angels.
I'm sure.
It's so much fun. It just brings out such joy, and it's just happy music from our youth. And these girls. The Blossoms sang with Tom Jones for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we all love a 20-year gig.
Well, you earned it.
World.
That's awesome.
Absolutely.
That's just truly awesome.
So being with them has just been, I don't have to work hard. You know what I mean? It just flows, and it's music that we know. And so getting together and rehearsing and just ironing out all of the little kinks, that is so much fun because, we want to recreate the sound. you know, we want to be true to the sound and true to the music, and it's just so much fun to do. I just feel so blessed, and Finita is an absolute joy to work with.
Well, you know, thank God we all have YouTube and that sort of thing. We can go back to the past and mm-hmm. and see and hear the things that you know, shaped my childhood. Dick Clark and you know, just the Elvis and the Ray Charles and all that stuff. I mean, we didn't have segregated radio then. We didn't have where you have just, you know, a country format and a top 40 country format or a top, or you know what I'm saying, and the pop thing and you know, it was all just music. I didn't know there was country music when I was 10 years old. I had no idea there was country music. It's what I heard on the radio.
My parents are from Mississippi, so when I would go visit my grandmother and I would be helping her iron and my chores, and I would be, she'd give me a cold Coca-Cola, and I'd be in there ironing, and she'd say, "Now here's the radio, you can listen to whatever you want." And I would just be turning the dial, and so I would hear these, what I came to understand was country music later, but I would be listening to the Grand Ole Opry broadcast and just turning the dial, you know, looking for some rock and roll music.
Mm-hmm.
But those nights of listening to that music when I was ironing or when we were falling asleep, it was just so, it just took you to another world. It just was just another, it was so comforting, and it sparked your imagination. It made you dream. It made you imagine. It made you plan your life. It's like, that's what music did for me. It really helped me map out how I wanted to live.
I can see that. Absolutely.
And what I wanted to do. And of course that, you know, having a showbiz career was, like I said, was my secret for so many years, but I was encouraged by the music I listened to on the radio, and those nights of just, you know, mosquitoes and fireflies buzzing around outside and looking outside and seeing the stars and listening to that music was so comforting to me. And I've got friends, we've all got a story about that, you know, going to bed with the transistor radio underneath our ear.
Absolutely, at night. You bet.
At night, you know.
That was our cable TV.
Absolutely. Oh my God.
I mean, it was you know, turning the volume down where your mom and dad couldn't hear you still being up, and you take that finger and you inch it across the dial and you listen to Detroit and you listen to Chicago and all those old things.
And maybe you could get Wolfman Jack, you know, you could get him, you know, way out in California. So it was an incredible journey across the United States, but just to pick up those AM signals. We didn't have FM.
Yeah. Yep.
So that was an incredible. That's something that we have in common. So many of us, we talk about that, and I remember when I got my first transistor radio, honey, I thought I had it going on.
You did. You absolutely did.
I would put it in my pencil. I had a pencil case.
Mm-hmm.
It was a zip thing. It was a little plastic thing, and I would stick it in there. And so when I would be walking home from school, I would just whip it out. And if I had the little earpiece, I would stick the earpiece in my ear, and it would be winter time, and I could listen to, you know, the local radio station in Chicago as I was walking from school. That was so comforting to me.
Mm-hmm.
That was like, I just take you into another world, you know.
Well, it was like being in that particular city. You'd never been to Detroit. You'd never been to St. Louis,
right,
or, you know, everything that
exactly
surrounds where you're at now.
In that era. Exactly.
I mean, it's why I love Philadelphia now. It's why I love Detroit. Oh, it's why I love St. Louis and Cincinnati and all these places. They were just, they could come right to your ear, and you were like you were there, and you just had an imagination that wouldn't quit, and you know, I think kids and today's people have lost that a little bit.
Well, I can tell you that from my like I said, I've got a son. He's 20 years old. I raised him up in, he came up in the business with me, you know, having him as a mature mother. he was at every choir rehearsal. I mean, from an infant, he was a toddler, little kid at choir rehearsal with me.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting, you know, at rehearsal in the studio with me as a baby, you know, recording studio, rehearsal studio, take him to the gig. Sometimes it was an early evening kind of gig. I take him with me, you know. And so he grew up seeing mommy on the stage. He grew up being around musicians. And so when I was touring with Hairspray in 2000, from 2003 to 2006, my family came on the road with me for a year. Homeschooled my son. We bought a big old truck. We just got somebody to house it for us here in L.A. And, honey, we took off. And listening to the radio going across the country.
Yep.
And stopping off at truck stops and, you know, having that experience of just going, looking at the map and, like, we got to be here and just hitting the road. And when we got to the theater, some nights he would just come to work with me and sit in the pit with the conductor. And it would just warm my heart. Sometimes he'd sit with the conductor, sometimes he'd sit with the rhythm section. And now he's a musician. So, but he got to sit with my friend. He'd sit between the guitar player and the bass player. And that was his education. Just, that really spurred him in his music education. And so this kind of enrichment, I wanted him to have that. I wanted him to have, my husband, I wanted him to have something that we could never dream of being, having that experience at his age.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
At 9, 10, 11, 12. And so that was a blessing to be able to do that for him. And he learned so much just hanging around the guys in the pit. You know, he learned about the business. Sometimes he'd sit with the sound man, you know, or sit with the lighting guy, or stand at the call desk with the stage manager. So he really got to learn what theater is about. And being around professionals who love what they do. What a blessing to be with people who love their work. They're not complaining, you know, they're not, you know,
mm-hmm.
they're not, you know, they don't have an axe to grind, but they love what they do. They're there because they love this business in whatever capacity it might be. So that was important to have him have that experience. But boy, oh boy, I wouldn't trade that for anything for him. I'm so glad that I was able to give that to him.
You know, that's something you can't pay for.
You can't pay for it.
You can't enroll in it. You can't,
well,
you
I
can't
have,
do those
I took
things.
A lot of criticism from people about it, but I just said, well, you know what? I was a stay-at-home mom for 9 years. I just stayed home here in L.A. and I auditioned and I did a lot of sessions. I was singing background in an R&B band, but I was mostly at home, and that's where I wanted to be. And when I got that show, we made a decision after the first 6 months that my family, that they were going to come with me.
That's
I'm
awesome.
I'm glad that I did it.
Oh,
and that
yeah.
was awesome. And I thank God for that. That's an incredible blessing for me. We grew as a family, and you go through your seasons in life of you do one thing for a few years and then you transition to something else. In our business, anyway, and you know you try to keep home and hearth together. And my husband and I, we really worked together on that, and I'm grateful for him because he, you know, people. You know, you listen to stories about, like, Dolly Parton's story about her and her husband, you know. And this is a man who, very confident in himself, but he knows that she, you know, she got to go do what she got to do.
Exactly.
And he, you know, he never handed her, but, you know, their time together is their time, you know. I took a few lessons out of her playbook in that sense that there's no reason why you can have a private life with your family and be in this business and maintain, you know, you take care of home and take care of your people and get ready to go to work. This is mommy's job. This is what she goes and she does. I mean, it's crazy fun. You know what I mean?
But, yeah, it's something you can't teach.
She really encouraged me. How she maintained her relationship with her husband and family and everything was just, it just really, really spoke to me. So there's choices that we get to make and how we want to live this life in this business. And there are a lot of people in film and in television and in music who, you know, they live quiet and peaceable lives outside of getting up and going and doing their doing their gig. Everything isn't under scrutiny, is up for scrutiny or public, you know, viewing.
Mm-hmm. And it's tough. It's tough, but it's worth it. It's an experience that not everybody can have and not everybody wants. But once you taste it, I think you have to have it. And that's kind of what I'm feeling here is just the realness of growing up in a thing where it's not a formal education, but it's just it's a growing up. It's a learning. It's what's going to get you through your life.
Exactly. And you know what? It's interesting because it does become a form of a formal education because you're hitting the ground running.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're learning it as you go. And then with applied education, you know, with formal education factored in there at some point, wherever you're able to grab a hold of it, it really does enrich you because it's interesting because right now so much of our 20 feet from stardom experience and every time we go to a screening and we have a talk back, it is an educational opportunity. It's a teachable moment. It's really opened up avenues. We've been screening the movie at colleges and universities and have, you know, for their media departments and their music and their fine arts departments and having the most amazing conversations, the most amazing dialogue opens up. And it's, you know, when I'm with elementary school and junior high school young people who are looking to go into the industry and who are, you know, taking music or art or dance or your musical theater majors, we get to have a conversation about excellence, about team playing, about the sacredness of maintaining your art and that you are your instrument. And it just opens up this dialogue of nurturing the soul of an artist. And, you know, so many of us come into this life, you know, some of us get nurtured in some areas and some of us don't. But when you're dealing with someone who has an artistic nature, expression, painting, writing, media, acting, composing, you know, stage crafting, people need to be encouraged because so many people are not.
Exactly.
God has given us gifts and talents, and he wants us to develop those gifts and talents in excellence and execute them in excellence, but most of all, love and service. And it's about being of service to one another, to be being a blessing to one another. And it isn't always about money, because the money will be there, but it's about just being of, as you go your way, as you traverse, as you meet all these people and have these conversations and stand on stages and do whatever it is that you do, the millions of people that you are reaching through the internet and free radio or however way it's getting out there, it's about being of service and being a blessing and lifting people up. That's the thing that really got me when I was a young girl, watching TV, going to movies. There was something about the music that lifted me up. There was something about that person that lifted me up. When I went to Graceland, I took my husband and my son. We went in 2005. We went to Graceland. And it was right after Christmas. It was actually right before New Year's. And we're standing at the door. You know, have you ever been to Graceland?
No, ma'am, but I'd like to.
Oh my God! So we're standing at the door. They put you on a little shuttle and then they drive you up the driveway. So you stand at the front door. I'm looking inside, and there was about 25 people behind me, taking like groups of like 25. So I'm standing at the door and I'm looking through the glass of the doorway, and I'm looking up this carpeted stairs, and they had these beautiful red poinsettias coming down the stairs, and to my left, there's a picture, a beautiful oil painting of Elvis. And I'm thinking this man's going to walk down the stairs. Hmm. And then I hear the guide say, "Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Presley family, We wish you a God bless and happy holidays, and welcome to Graceland. I burst into tears because we're walking into the home of a man who set the world on fire.
Changed the world.
Changed
it musically, changed it in films.
Culturally, particularly here in the United States, just blew it up. Never ever the same again.
It's an amazing thing what Elvis and put into people. I remember we lived in Virginia back in, I think it was around 1967-68, and my mom and dad took me to the drive-in, and my mom was driving, and it was supposed to be an Elvis thing. You know, they were having several Elvis movies, and we're driving and trying to find a place next to a speaker, and Elvis comes on, and my mom stops dead right there in the middle of the road and just gawks. And my dad's like, "You're blocking traffic. You need to pull in here." I can't, and she was just stuck. And I'm looking out the back window, and here's these cars behind us, and they're wanting to honk, and my mom is just stuck. She couldn't get out of it. And I just remember that as part of how I remember Elvis and how I remember, those days of because we didn't have everything at our fingertips. We didn't have everything.
When we would get a movie magazine and devour it, my auntie had a million of them. When we would get that movie magazine and read that, and that was already weeks and weeks and weeks, from whatever was happening, and we'd read about it. I mean, that would become Bible.
Yeah.
But that experience going to Graceland set something off in my thinking about what I'm doing, or what I've been doing, or what I've dedicated my whole life to, and how I wanted to live the rest of my life. Of course, he had a very tragic end. It didn't have to be that way, but and I cried all through the house. I couldn't stop crying, and by the time I got to the gravesite, I was just a wreck. I was just sitting there, I was just weeping and just going, you could have stayed a little longer. But it was just bittersweet experience, but it made me think about the rest of how do you want to spend the rest of your life in this business?
Yep.
What kind of legacy do you want to leave behind?
I think you've left a wonderful one.
Yes.
You have.
And encouraging. And I got to meet so many people who worked with him, and they all said the same thing. This is a man who loved God. This is a man who all he wanted to do after the show was sing hymns and spirituals and songs and hymns and spiritual songs. So that encouraged me, too, to keep the faith.
Well, I think you've done a wonderful job at all of it.
Thank you.
I kind of feel like I've taken a lot of your time.
Honey, I'm telling you, I blocked it all out today for you. So
okay.
I appreciate you.
Well, I appreciate you too, because it's firsthand account of history and how people, drove their careers to make us all memories that. We can't get rid of. I can't get rid of those memories. I can't get rid of those songs. I can't get rid of, not that I want to, but they're just there and they're part of you. And it's just amazing that I get to talk to some of these people that really make our memories, and people that make your memories are people you never forget.
That's right.
You never forget them. And before I let you go, I know we're really, really running late here, but I know you had the film Behind the Candelabra, and I also know that you're on the touring cast for Hairspray, and you're working with Mick Jagger and that sort of thing. Can you just give me a real quick rundown of that real quick, and I'm going to try to let you out of here.
Behind the Candelabra, I auditioned for it. I played one of Liberace's maids, and I'm in the scene with another actress. Her name is Nakia Gamby Turner. She and I are housekeepers at the penthouse where Matt Damon, who plays Liberace's boyfriend, Scott, he's being thrown out. And it's very interesting because Dan Aykroyd played Liberace's manager and in the movie, and I used to sing with the same background for Danny when he had the Elwood Blues review. So that was a lot of fun to be with him and be in that setting and work with Steven Soderbergh. It was just so much fun, and we're just so excited it was really a wonderful experience, and I knew that they were going to win a lot of awards. But the interesting thing is that it was done for HBO, but then it was released theatrically in Europe. So he got an Olivier Award for his work, and Michael Douglas did. And so I was just so excited to be a part of that. It was such a gift. And we did. I did Hairspray from 2003 to 2006, the first national tour, and I closed it out on Broadway in 2009. So hopefully they're going to bring it back, and hopefully I'll get to do it again.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So many cool things. Just really awesome.
Mouth Mabel.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know that I remember seeing that movie, and I do have vague remembrances of her and some of the other cast, and it's just a great movie.
You can pull it up. You can pull me up in the first national tour on YouTube, singing "I Know Where I've Been."
Well, let's all do that.
Yes, dude, that's a wonderful cast. And then when we did a Broadway with Harvey Fierstein, it was amazing.
Just awesome.
Yes. Yeah, we had a lot of fun.
I bet you did. Is there anything else you want to tell us real quick?
Well, you know, I just, for people that are interested in finding out more stuff about me, they can Google me at Charlotte Crossley, CharlotteCrossley, and visit me on my Facebook page, which is Charlo Crossley, Fortier, Fortier, that's my married name, and visit me and friend me on Facebook. They can find me on Twitter. I'm not on Instagram yet, but I'd love to hear from everyone.
Oh, I think everybody would love to hear from you.
And keep in touch with you, my friend.
Yes, ma'am.
I appreciate you so very much.
I really want to do a part two here. I think it warrants a part two.
Okay. We can do that at any time. I appreciate you. And there's some wonderful things that are coming up for me at my extended play, Charlo Live at the Gardenia, it's being mastered right now, and that's going to be hopefully by the fall that'll be ready, and I'm going to be selling it on on one of those outlets on the internet.
Everywhere, yeah. Everywhere. That's fine. That's great. I'll be here to help you with that too.
Yes, absolutely. And I just appreciate you so much. And we'll keep you posted about what the Blossoms are doing. And
sure.
I just appreciate you so much, Mr. Steve Martin.
Well, I appreciate you, Miss Charlo Crossley. hang on, though. Don't hang up on me just yet. I want to tell everybody again, even though the dog's not barking through this, but July 5th, 2014 at 6 p.m., Charlo will be opening up for the Supreme Partners live show at the Sheraton Gateway at the Los Angeles International Airport. In Los Angeles, you can call for tickets at 213-494-1291. Be sure and check that out. There's plenty of seats still available. There's a couple of things I need to mention credit-wise before I get off here. I need to mention that our co-producer is Ms. Ray Aroma. She's been invaluable in putting this show together and many others, and we love Ray for that. I'd also like to thank my wife, Betty Martin, who's our technical advisor. If Betty couldn't fix what I tore up, we wouldn't be here today, and I appreciate her for that. And Jimmy Lawson, Space Coast Eye Radio in Melbourne, Florida, for playing this show and many others. I'd like to thank Big Dog Productions for bringing us together. I'd like to thank the Ardent Agency for having the faith in me to bring some of these fine artists to my air, and I do appreciate that. I'd like to mention OperationBlanketsOfLove.org, where you can take a blanket, a sheet, any kind of a linen item to an animal shelter and help make an animal a little bit more comfortable while he waits to be adopted. We appreciate that as well. And I'd also like to mention SavingCanineLivesPlus.org. My friend Bobby Kimball and his wife Jasmine in the greater Los Angeles area working to help the dogs and animals in need out there. And I'd also like to thank God for the opportunity of speaking with Charlo today and discussing her career. And I'm Steve Martin, your host. Until next time, enjoy the music.